Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Good afternoon, and thanks for joining me. We've got another delicious adventure today, a delicious show, and I want to talk today with our guest, Mary Beth Abrams, who is a nutritionist, cooking instructor, public speaker, corporate chef for Vitasoy USA, and spokesperson for the North American Vegetarian Society. She's known for her enthusiastic demeanor and has appeared on radio and television discussing food and nutrition, hosts the cooking DVD Tofu 123 with Olympic athlete Carl Lewis, and is the author of the cookbook Tofu 123, and also the Four Ingredient Vegan, which we'll be talking a little bit about in the show, as well as the column Ask Mary Beth in Vegetarian Voice magazine, for which she is also an associate editor. She provides nutritional counseling for weight loss, detoxification, food allergies, and healthy eating for the treatment and prevention of various diseases. She's a certified first-line therapy lifestyle educator. She received her bachelor's degree from Emory University, her master's degree from Georgia State University, and her nutrition training from the Global College of Natural Medicine. She is board-certified by the American College of Drugless Practitioners. Mary Beth, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Karen.
Yeah.
It's nice to be here.
I'm really looking forward to talking with you because I've been all over your website and looking through your cookbook, and you're somebody that I want to know.
Oh, I'm sorry. For some reason, I just heard a funny sound. Can you just repeat that?
Okay. Are we having trouble with the sound here?
It was just a little thing, so I don't think it's an
okay.
ongoing thing.
Cool. Okay, so anyway, I was just saying that you're somebody that I would like to know based on everything that I've read on your website. You're doing wonderful things.
Oh, thank you, Karen. You know what? I am absolutely blessed to have my occupation just correspond with what my passion is, my occupation and my passion. It's a really great thing to be able to do.
Now, what I want to do is start from the beginning, and I want to know how you got so involved in this passion for food and helping people get healthy.
Yeah, oh, I love that question. We all love telling our stories.
Well,
you know,
even before you tell it, I want to tell you why I ask it, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it's an obvious question, but I think people need to know that we're all real people.
Yeah.
And that we've all had real experiences, and that when we hear individual stories, we can relate to them and know that we can make differences, too.
Yes, yes, absolutely. About 20 years ago, when I was living in Atlanta, I took a course, an adult ed course, called Going Vegetarian. And in that course, it was a three-evening course, and the first two sessions, we learned about the environmental impact of diet. We learned about the ethics involved with where our food comes from, and we also learned about the health benefits of a plant-based diet. And the third evening was a potluck dinner, a vegan potluck dinner. We all made stuff and shared the recipes and the whole thing. After taking that course, I became vegan soon after taking that course. And it was a defining time for me going through that. And I moved up to Connecticut a few years later and decided that I wanted to start teaching a similar class in my own community here in Connecticut. And at the time, I was a stay-at-home mom when I moved up to Connecticut. And so, I had some time.
Right.
And so I started running this class through Adult Ed and modeling it after the class that I had taken in Atlanta. And I noticed that attendance was not as high as I would like it to be. The class was called Going Vegetarian, just like the class in Atlanta was called. And it was really, it was people who were already thinking about becoming vegetarian or vegan that were attracted to the class. So it wasn't real, it didn't seem like it was appealing to the mainstream. So what I did after about a year or two was I changed it to just doing cooking classes.
Right.
I didn't call them vegan cooking classes. They were names like cholesterol-free cooking for a healthy heart. Or,
right.
you know, lactose-free delicious foods for people who are lactose intolerant, dairy-free foods for people who are lactose intolerant, or, you know, high-fiber meals, you know, 30 minutes or less, all kinds of things like that. All the classes were vegan, and they were filled to the brim every single time I offered them. And I realized after a short amount of time that I could give out the exact same nutrition information that I would be giving out in that previous class in the format of the cooking class, and it was the information was going to a much wider audience. For example, somewhere in the class, somebody would always ask, well, if we're, you know, granted this is really great, it's for our heart, there's no meat in it though, how are we supposed to get our protein? And then I would explain how somebody gets their protein if they are living completely on a plant-based diet. And so that information, you know, would get out. And then usually sort of on the tail of that would be the whole cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
The whole calcium, the whole calcium issue, everything. People would always ask, you know, what about the calcium, the whole
right.
thing. And I realized that pretty much all of the nutrition information that would have been given out in that educational class could be given out in that cooking class to a much wider audience. Those cooking classes eventually grew into more nutrition classes. For example, companies would come and have me do like a lunch and learn presentation.
Mm.
You know, during this time, I was attending all of the annual conferences from the North American Vegetarian Society and reading a lot of books. I was working for the North American Vegetarian Society magazine, and I had to do a lot of book reviews for them. So I would be forced, you know, in a very nice way, to really stay up on all the research. And I was educating myself this whole time, so my nutrition talks would get more and more just valuable to everybody. And so eventually I wanted to be able to work with individuals instead of just doing all these group presentations. And so I went back to get my credentials to become a nutritionist, and that was about 4 years ago.
Great. Well, people certainly like it when you have credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good thing to have, but there are plenty of people with lots of credentials that still don't know much about nutrition, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the irony. That's true.
But you touch on so many interesting points. I think people have a fascination with food, and so many of us love food. And unfortunately, we've gotten lost. We're like that lost herd, and we've gotten so far away from the kitchen and knowing what goes in our foods and how to prepare foods. And then we hear all of these horrible sound bites from the media about nutrition that are so out of context very often, that people are so overwhelmed, so confused. And for some strange reason, and I don't know exactly where it all comes from, people hang on to a few keywords: protein, calcium, cholesterol after a while got a lot of press. Some people are more familiar with omega-3 fatty acids, although they have no idea what they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they have a combination of fear and curiosity and ignorance. It's really fascinating, actually.
It is. One of the things that I do with my clients, because usually the information that I give them is so different from what they've been spoon-fed from society, from the time that they've grown up, is I invite them to kind of like do an experiment. Like, let's see how you feel after a week of not consuming any dairy.
Mm.
Or, you know, let's see how you feel when you increase your vegetables to about 5 times more than what you're used to. You know, let's see how you feel when you add some beans and take away some of the meat, all of that. And I really monitor how people are feeling. And as long as someone's feeling good, it's been my experience that they want to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I've been doing lately is giving people pH test strips.
Mm.
So they can really easily at home test the pH of their urine to get
mm-hmm.
a sense of where their body is. And to show them that there really is some kind of an interchange going on as they shift more and more to a plant-based diet. And even if they're already in a plant-based diet, how to further alkalize the body
right.
for even further prevention of disease. It's something that I'm really fascinated with, and it's actually kind of fun. Like, let's see how high I can get my pH today, you know, because we want to have a pH in our urine that's between 7 and 8. And, you know, see what happens after you eat a whole thing of cabbage. go ahead and test your pH.
Yeah, those pH
about an hour or two later. It's a great experiment.
It's really clever. The pH strips are a lot of fun. They're relatively inexpensive. You can shop around online for different ones, but I have an engineering background, and so I love collecting data.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a great way to really make some correlations with what you're eating and what it's doing in your body.
Yeah.
So, very good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. We have a lot more to talk about, but I'm going to have us take a quick little break, and what I want you to do, Mary Beth, is hang up so we can call you back, and maybe we'll get a little clearer line.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Very, very good. Okay.
Okay, so we'll be right back.
Great.
I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And I'm here with Mary Beth Adams. And we are here to offer you any information about nutrition and answer any questions you might have. You can send me a quick email that I can respond to. Send it to info@realmeals.org. I know you're online listening, so you can easily send an email if you have a question. And you can always call in at 1-888-874-4888. Okay, Mary Beth.
Hi, Karen.
Okay, I think we got a better, clearer connection.
Yeah.
Very good. So you worked with Olympic athlete Carl Lewis in a cooking DVD.
Yeah, that was fun.
What was that like?
It was great. You know, around that time, a very good friend of mine came to me, and she said that she was planning on producing a tofu cooking video. And she asked me if I would like to be in it, and I said, absolutely. And so we worked together to do this cooking video. And this friend of mine, her name is Diane Wageman of Divine Treasures Chocolates in Manchester,
mm-hmm.
Connecticut. It's actually like his vegan oasis. It's very cool. Anyway, she had a dream one night. She said, I dreamed that Carl Lewis was in this DVD. And I said, well, that's interesting because he actually has a vegan cookbook. You know, he's worked with Dr. McDougall. You know, he's very interested in this topic, I think. And so she was able to track him down, and we ended up going out there to do a bunch of filming out to California. And it was wonderful. It was a great experience. It was fun. We took a little run together, even if it really was just the purpose of the photograph. But he's really into health, into a real healthy diet, not just the healthy version of the standard American diet, but what I would consider to be a true healthy diet.
Well, one of the reasons why I bring it up is people definitely have a tendency to pay attention more or listen about nutrition when either their doctor is talking or when a celebrity is involved.
Yeah, and that was the reason why we were happy to be able to have him be a part of that. And in the DVD, he talked about how he felt it was his vegan diet that gave him the extra edge to win all those gold medals in the Olympics. I don't know what year it was. It was way back when, but he not only just won tons and tons of gold medals, but he was named Olympic Athlete of the Year and then Olympic Athlete of the Decade as well. And apparently the entire track team at the time kind of took notice of what he was doing in terms of how the way he was eating, and everybody kind of got into eating the high vegetable diet at that point.
Right. And the point is, you don't have to be an Olympic athlete, but if you want to live a happy, healthy life with longevity and quality living and feeling good, plants are your friends.
It is so true. And, you know, even as a nutritionist, you know, and I've been into this for a long time, I'm sure that all the listeners will understand what I'm saying here. No matter where we are on the spectrum of healthy eating, there's always a little bit of room for improvement. We like to take these baby steps, like we hear about some food that's really good to eat or maybe a food we should cut back on, and we want to do it. We want to keep moving in that direction, adding more raw, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that I've done over the past few years is I truly have increased my pure vegetables higher and higher and higher than they've ever been. Like, I'll, and I do that because I feel like I'm getting older and I need that edge. I want to stay young in my body biologically. So it's not uncommon for me to cut a purple cabbage in half and chop that thing up and eat it for breakfast, you know. Now, granted, I have a little bit of a weakness for Annie's Goddess dressing, and I like to sprinkle the Duels and the Nutritional Yeast Flakes on top also. But I feel so good when I eat a very large volume of vegetables, especially the cruciferous vegetables and all the dark green vegetables, and I advocate it to everybody.
Right. Here's to cruciferous vegetables. My favorite are the green ones.
Yeah.
And we can't. We literally can't eat enough of them, and when we're filled from them, from all the fiber, that's when we've had enough.
Exactly. It's like all of a sudden something just shuts off. It's like, I'm done now. There's really no concern about overeating.
You can.
The more that we eat of that.
Yeah, not those foods. Now, just one quick question, tofu 1 through 3. You don't have to eat tofu if you don't like it. You don't have to eat tofu if you have an allergy to soy. But let's talk a minute. People always ask, oh, but I've heard soy isn't a healthy food. There are problems with it. And I try and bring this up a lot on the show just because enough people aren't talking about it. But can we talk about soy being a healthy food?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a topic that I know a lot of people are interested in. It always comes up, like, what's the story with soy? Is it bad?
Yeah.
Is it good? I want to, you know, reiterate what you just said. Nobody has to eat it. You don't have to eat soy in order to be vegetarian or anything like that. The way that I view it, certain soy foods enable me to prepare certain foods that my family really likes. For example, they love having a chocolate cream pie once in a while, and I can do that with silk and tofu. You know, it'd be difficult to make something like that without it. I mean, it's certainly possible, but it'd be a little bit more of a challenge. So it gives me a little bit of flexibility. So it's nice to be able to have it once in a while. In terms of just living on it, like people who have, you know, like, you know, soy sausage in the morning with tofu scrambler and then, you know, a veggie burger at lunch and then some grilled tofu at dinner, I would say that falls into the category of not varying your diet quite enough.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're eating that much soy, which comes from soybeans, you're not eating a lot of lentils or black beans or white beans or kidney beans. So you want to keep it really varied. The other thing is we want to avoid processed food as much as we can. So things like the fake hot dogs and everything might be really useful when someone's transitioning toward a plant-based diet. Or if they just want to have fun, like they want, you know, to have a vehicle to eat all that sauerkraut and mustard. You got to have a fake hot dog to put
on. Yeah, at least on July 4th.
You know, once in a while. But aside from that, having soy once in a while is really not problematic. You know, assuming you don't have an allergy, you know, you haven't been told that it's going to cause some problem for you by your doctor. The way that what most people seem to really want to know about, though, is the estrogen. What about all the estrogen in soy? And there's so much information kind of pro and con on it, but what I have come to the conclusion for myself with this is the fact that the estrogens in soy are very, very weak compared to the estrogens that our body makes naturally. And the amount of estrogen that our body makes is going to depend on how much fat we eat and or how much fat is on our body. So if we have a lot of fat on our body or if we're eating a lot of fat, we're probably going to be making a lot of estrogen. And that estrogen is pretty strong stuff, and it can contribute to estrogen-fed tumors, for example, breast cancer. Now, our cells have estrogen receptor sites on them where the estrogen floating around in our body can kind of, you know, lock onto and go into the cells. But if we have this weak estrogen floating around in our body, it instead will latch onto those estrogen receptor sites, thereby blocking out the harmful stuff. And according to researchers, that's the reason why people who grow up in cultures where soy is consumed and the fat is very low overall tend to have less breast cancer. And it's even been suspected that adding soy to a diet here in this country can actually block out some of that harmful stuff in the manner that I just described. So even though there's a lot of research kind of showing both ways, that's what I've really kind of settled on because it makes sense to me.
I think most of the research actually sways towards the fact that soy is healthy and does work towards preventing cancer rather than promoting illness. But like you said, there's healthy soy and there's not so healthy soy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to really be clear about that. We can't just dump it all in the same bucket. So organic, non-genetically modified tofu, tempeh, edamame, miso, soy milk, these are all healthy, simple foods. The ones that are highly processed with that
the
soy protein.
Oh, the soy protein isolate.
That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
Those are problematic. And and if you eat a lot of them and you use those pH strips, you'll see how your urine gets a little more acidic.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that always interests me, or fascinates me, I should say, is when some people who eat, say, chicken every day, and say, oh, my God, you know, I eat chicken every day, but, you know, God forbid I have a little bit of soy because of the estrogen.
Oh,
and I think to myself, you know, the chicken that you're eating is causing you to produce estrogen that is very harmful. It's really, you shouldn't be afraid of the soy while eating the chicken. And it also interests me that doctors out there will say, oh, don't eat the soy, but they won't tell somebody not to eat the chicken. I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. It's really crazy, but there's a lot of crazy misinformation going around about a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Tofu 1-2-3, I haven't had the privilege to see that book. But tofu can be magical, and it's wonderful in sweet dishes. It's wonderful in savory dishes. It can have so many different textures and take on the flavor of so many different things that I personally don't want to live without it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So here's to tofu.
Yeah, actually, can I share a funny story with the tofu cookbook? When I eat tofu maybe once a week. It's just, that's kind of about how often I eat it. And when I was working on the recipes for that cookbook, I had tofu just about every day for about a year.
Oh, gosh.
And by the end of the year, I was really tofu'd out, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes a while for a book to actually get published once you deliver the manuscript. So it probably was about a year later that the book actually came out. And at that time, I started doing a lot of cooking demos. I'd be invited to groups, you know, do presentations, things like that. And so I revisited the recipes at that time. I really barely touched any of them during that year after submitting the manuscript. So I'll never forget going to this vegetarian group. I'm pretty sure it was the vegetarian group, the Northern Connecticut Vegetarian Group. Yeah, I think that's what it's called. And I decided to make the loaded nachos. There's a recipe in Tofu 1-2-3 called loaded nachos.
Mm.
And I decided to make that for the cooking demo. And I cooked everything. I didn't have anything made in advance for this recipe. I just made everything on the spot, got ready to serve it. And right before serving it, I tasted it before giving it out. And I looked at everybody in the audience, and I said, this tastes really good. I'm not kidding. I was like amazed. I'm like, oh my God, this tastes really good, everybody. You got to taste this. And ever since then, I have to say that the loaded nachos recipe has been my favorite recipe in that entire cookbook. It's a cheese sauce that you put on top of chips, and you know, you add your guacamole and all that stuff on top of it. But I've just loved that cheese sauce, and it's an example of the textures and everything. I mean, it's a rich, creamy cheese sauce. It's not something that people always think of when you think of what could I make with tofu.
I went vegan a long time ago, and so I don't have this thing with cheese where I really miss it or I really feel like I need it, but a lot of people do. That's one of the things they say, oh, I can't live without cheese.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many wonderful ways to make cheesy things. And now there are more and more products that you can buy that are plant-based cheeses.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the more homemade things. One example is a recipe from the Four Ingredient Vegan. It's white bean nacho spread. I think that's what it's called. And the four ingredients are white beans, salsa, nutritional yeast flakes, and cashew butter.
Mm.
And it all goes in the food processor. So the white beans become the base, and they barely have any flavor at all. It's just a nice sort of, you know, sturdy base. The salsa makes it taste Mexican. The nutritional yeast flakes makes it taste cheesy, and the cashew butter gives it just a little bit of richness. And so it has sort of the consistency of hummus, but it tastes like a cheese spread. And, you know, that's just an example of one of the things. I mean, I have kids, and so I like making kind of stuff like that for them, and also cooking for people who are not vegetarian or vegan, and I like them to see that they can have these really delicious tastes.
Right.
That, you know, they wouldn't necessarily miss cheese as a result of.
Well, you know, too, a lot of people's palates are really, I'm trying to find the right word without being insulting, but are not very sophisticated at this point or very numbed because of all the processed foods that that are loaded with salt, sugar, and fat.
Yeah.
And a lot of the cheese that's used in at least fast food and some restaurant food is really low quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you come along and make a lot of these healthy plant-based alternatives, not only do they taste good, but so many people are used to low-quality cheese as it is that these substitutes are just so much more flavorful and superior.
Yeah. You know, it's really funny just to illustrate that point that you just said. I have two children aged 13 and 16, and they've been raised vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really good eaters. They like a lot of natural foods and everything. One day, this must have been about 2 years ago, my son inadvertently stuck his hand into a bag of, I don't know what they were, some kind of cheese doodly, nacho-flavored, chippy, I don't know what the heck they were, but he took a bite of it. I think it was a nacho-flavored chip.
With cheese in it.
With cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And he tasted it, and he said to me, he said, "Mom, I think there's something wrong with those chips. They taste like they're spoiled." You know, he was like, "Holy cow, what is that flavor?" You know? And this is like a number one product in our country.
Right.
He was disgusted by it. You know, and this was a really pure experiment, because he put his hand in there totally innocently.
Okay, you have two children, and they've been raised vegan?
Yeah.
And they're how old now?
They're 13 and 16.
How did you do it? Do they occasionally have things that aren't vegan outside of the household?
You know what I did? Well, the first couple of years was easy because, you know, we were with the kids all the time.
We'd
bring their lunch to the park, you know, all that stuff. I'll never forget, you know, it's really funny. I even wrote an article about this for Vegetarian Voice years and years ago. But it was the first time that my daughter was invited to some mainstream birthday party, and I think she was probably three.
Mm-hmm.
And it took place at one of these indoor places with the tubes and the party room, and you go in with the ball pit and the whole thing, and they serve pizza at these parties.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was the big deal. This was like, I've been doing this with her for 3 years. You know, are we going to be able to survive the birthday party? And what I decided to do was to bring her own pizza and just wrap it in some foil and discreetly take it out at the last minute. And she would know. I mean, it wasn't like she didn't know she was vegan at that point, but I was going to just let her know I was going to bring some vegan pizza and she'd have it, you know, if she wanted it. And it was just, I was thinking about it. What's everybody going to say? Are the other kids going to point and say, "Well, your pizza looks yucky"? You know, I really wasn't sure how it was going to go. So the big day comes, and we're there in the party room, and the kids are bouncing off the walls. Everybody's drinking soda. You know, it's just a mayhem scene in there. I give her pizza. I don't even think she noticed, let alone the other kids. And nobody even was aware of what anyone else was eating. Half the kids were on the floor, under the table. The bottom line is that it clearly was not an issue. But since that time, I took the approach with my kids that when you're not in the house, you know, if you're invited to a party, it's really up to you what you choose to eat. They understood why we were vegan. I mean, I started educating with that. I educated them to those reasons from the very, very, very get-go. So they knew why they were vegan. And if they were going to a party, I would say, just letting you know, I called the mom. They're going to be having pizza and chocolate cake. It's your business what you eat while you're there. You can either eat those foods. Just letting you know, there is you know, there is, you know, maybe there's like an egg that came out of a chicken in the cake. There might be some milk that came out of a cow. in the cake or in the cheese on the pizza. If you want, I can send you with your own chocolate cake, you know, your own pizza that doesn't have any, you know, cow or chicken stuff in it. It's up to you. And they would always say, I'd rather take my own stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's kind of how we did it. And to this day, I feel like they're kind of proud. They're proud to be vegan.
Well, that's an unusual story. Because and you've got some great kids, it sounds like, but probably there was some influence there. But so many children are so swayed by what's going on around them.
I know. I have to say, you know, I think I must have had just some luck on my side. I can't really claim all the credit, because to claim credit for all the good, you got to claim credit for all the bad, too. So for whatever reason, things fell into place. But we didn't watch television. You know, we would watch videos. So we didn't have the commercials. And the other thing I remember teaching them when they were about two is what commercials are. Like, we would go somewhere and we'd watch a commercial and there'd be some kids playing with some trucks and it looks like the trucks are going by themselves, even though like there's little matchbox things, and the kids are having such a blast. And after the commercial, we would talk about it, like, wow, that boy was playing with the cars. You know, and how did he look? Oh, he looked like he was having a wonderful life, and he was playing with the best toy in the world. And I'd be like, well, here's a little car. Here's a matchbox car. Can you make it do everything that the TV was? Well, no. I'm like, well, no, they made it look really exciting. They do all that so that you tell your mom you want to buy it. All they want is your money. They don't really care about anything else. Mm-hmm. So we used to actually analyze these commercials when we had the opportunity. And I think it made them look at commercials very skeptically. And they didn't want to be suckered into anything.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's
yeah,
really
it
brilliant.
Was.
You taught analytical thinking at a very young age,
yeah.
Where they could really be perceptive and mindful about what they were seeing.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, all kids are different. I mean, my kids happen to be extremely analytical, cognitive people. And so that really worked for them, thank goodness, because that was really the only thing I could come up with. And I'm sure that there are different ways to appeal to different kids.
Well, you probably know this, but there have been lots of studies that show that intelligent children tend to become vegetarian, and vegetarian children tend to have higher IQs. It goes both ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Intelligence and vegetables go together.
Yes, I can see why. And, of course, I just got to throw in a little thing there, also breastfeeding. And I don't know if there's a correlation right now with, you know, mothers who are vegetarian with breastfeeding and everything, but I do know that the longer a child breastfeeds, they're going to be smarter also.
Well, breastfeeding, we know more and more, is very, very important. But there's also information about the quality of a mother's breast milk based on what she eats. And there, for example, a meat eater is shown to have higher levels of toxins in her breast milk.
Oh, yeah. It's an incredible topic. A lot of people are not aware of this. But, you know, we store toxins in our fat. And one of the few ways to eliminate that is through our breast milk. So, of course, cows have toxins stored in their fat, and when they nurse or milk, whatever you want to call it, if it's going into a bottle that humans are going to drink, the humans are consuming the toxins that were previously stored in that cow's body. So, and the other thing with the toxins, meaning they're stored in our fat, and they bioaccumulate. I mean, after a lifetime of eating foods that contain toxins, we store up more and more and more and more in our fat. So when a person when a woman goes to breastfeed, she's been storing all these toxins in her body in her whole life, and she lets that go in her breast milk. The thing is that plants don't bioaccumulate pesticides the way meat and dairy and eggs do. Conventionally grown apples are not going to have as much pesticide in them as conventionally raised meat. You know, it's interesting because strawberries get a really bad rap. Like, oh, my God, you know, conventionally raised strawberries. And it is true that they are loaded with pesticides, but it's nothing compared to conventionally raised animal products.
That's right.
It doesn't even come close.
Well, ideally, if it's best to eat organic, locally grown plant foods, and we want to support all of that so that those businesses are the ones that grow, making that quality food more available for everyone. But, yeah, meat, chicken, fish, they're all loaded with all kinds of toxic contamination that they accumulate and concentrate. So one bite of that stuff is so much worse than a conventional fruit or vegetable.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I want to reiterate what you just said, too. You got to go with organic. You just have to. It's just critical. If someone out there, though, is eating, is going to Burger King and Hardee's and coming home and saying, oh, my God, I won't touch that strawberry, they got to take a look at the meat that they're eating because that's causing tremendous harm in terms of pesticides.
Amen.
Yeah.
Okay, so what motivated putting together this new cookbook, The Four Ingredient Vegan?
You know, remember those cooking classes I was telling you about?
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. These classes would usually take place in my own community, at least in the beginning. And so, you know, months later, weeks later, years later, I would bump into people in the supermarket who I had seen in my classes. And, you know, they would tell me, oh, I still make the such and such. You know, I really love that recipe. And I realized that, not surprisingly, it was the really simple, easy recipes that people just lived on. Those were the recipes that became part of everyone's just everyday, weekly repertoire of what they made for dinner. So I started to focus more on those kinds of foods. I'm an easy chef anyway. That's sort of my thing. You know, I don't do the gourmet. But one year at the Vegetarian Summerfest, I did a cooking demo called, I think, Four Ingredient Wonders. And it was just dishes that only contained four ingredients. And Jo Stepanek from the book publishing company, she was there and she said, you know what, Mary Beth, that would be an awesome idea for your next book. And that was really all I needed to hear. I just sort of ran with it and put together a proposal. But an example, I remember way back then, one of the recipes that I did at that demo was the lentil walnut pate, which is lentils, sauteed onion, walnuts blended together with a little bit of veganaise stirred in.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes this really wonderful pate. And another one I did that day was I don't remember what I called it back then, but what the idea is to sort of make mashed potatoes, but you add a bunch of white beans to it that are mashed, and you mix it all together. And at the time, my kids were really little, and that was just, they loved mashed potatoes, and I could just make them a bowl of this stuff. It was like half potato, half bean, and I could just tell them, eat as much of it as you want, you know?
Right.
And I think it may have had roasted garlic in it, too, and that was really good.
Yummy.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a clever thing to do with kids. They turn their nose up at a lot of things and say, I don't like that, because they don't know what it is. They're not familiar with it, or it might have a texture that they're not familiar with. And the trick is to find a way to disguise the food or change the texture so that it seems familiar to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they learn how to eat new foods.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so I just want to talk about a few recipes that I like in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm a tahini nut.
Oh, yeah, I love tahini.
Now, tahini actually comes from a seed, but I'm a nut about tahini. Tahini is a butter made from sesame seeds. It's like peanut butter, only it's a little more beige in color, and it's from ground sesame seeds. And it is so good for so many things, sweet or savory. And you have a halva recipe with pitted dates, tahini, cashew butter, and vanilla.
Yeah.
Now, halva is an ancient treat made from sesame seeds and usually with sugar or honey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very simple dessert. It's like how would you describe it? It's like a hard, but it melts in your mouth or breaks.
Yeah, it's
not
almost
really,
like a really, almost like a dry paste, sort of. I'm trying to think of how to describe it. You know, I remember growing up, my family is Jewish,
mm-hmm.
and especially at Passover, somehow there'd always be a tin of halva at the end of the meal. It was the only time of year that we ever ate it. I have no idea where it came from. I would never see it in the rest of the year, but it was such a special treat.
Yeah, and it's very simple. Mm-hmm. And you have a simple recipe here that uses even better ingredients, so it's like up a notch.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's another tahini recipe I want to point out. I don't know if it's one that you flagged or not, but there's a recipe in there called sesame cabbage. It's one of my favorite recipes in the whole book. It's steamed cabbage, and then you make a little sauce with tahini and miso and a little bit of water. And just put it right there on top of the steamed tahini and add some pepper, and it's just outrageous.
Well, here's the thing. You can take lots of vegetables and steam them, so you're going to get all the great nutrition that you need from them with very little calories, and then you add some of this wonderful sauce.
Yeah.
And that's really, it makes anything delicious. There are just a few ingredients for me that make things taste fabulous. So what are they? Sauteed onions, garlic, lime juice, and tahini.
Ooh, yeah.
Maybe, and together or alone, but they all like enhance the flavor of foods.
Mm-hmm.
Tahini's definitely a big one.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, speaking of the sauces, I just have to give a little plug for this cookbook that I don't know if many people know about it. It's called The Saucy Vegetarian by Joe
Stepanek. Yeah.
It's a fabulous cookbook. It's just all sauces. And all you have to do is throw a few things together and stir them in a bowl or put them in a blender, and it's amazing.
Well, what I like about it, and I'm going to say the same about your cookbook, is that it's like a training book where you kind of get the hang of things with ingredients you may not be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just a few ingredients and really simple and so many variations, so if you used it like a training book, the sauces, again, the saucy vegetarian, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You kind of get the hang of it so that afterwards you can do it on your own, really.
Yes. You know, I am so happy that you mentioned that. That's one of the things that that I like to think about with this cookbook is that once you've made the recipe once,
mm-hmm.
you don't really have to read the recipe again if you want to make it a second time.
Right.
And to me, that's the best kind of cookbook because, I mean, I don't know about other people, but I'm not going to be reading a recipe every single night. Most of the stuff I make for dinner, I just do from the top of my head. And it's because I've made certain dishes over and over again over the years, and I know what I like and what's easy and what tastes good. You don't have to measure, you know,
mm-hmm.
if it's a half an onion or a whole onion or whatever. And that's what I was aiming for with these recipes. It's almost all of them that you would not have to follow the recipe after making it once.
Okay, so if you're one of those people, and I don't know how many there are, but I'd say maybe a third up to a half of the population are kind of lost in terms of what to do in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good book to get your feet wet. If you want to get healthy or just you want some more ideas, this is The 4-Ingredient Vegan, and it's by you, Mary Beth Abrams, along with Ann Dinshaw.
Yeah.
And I really, really recommend it. Ann Dinshaw, I didn't bring her up before, but she helped you with this book.
Yeah, Ann contributed, I think, about 20 recipes to the book. She added, you know, she cooks differently from the way that I do, and I think it added a really nice variety. She's got some things in there made with phyllo dough, some really interesting desserts. She's got a lot in there, but there are like a good 20 recipes that she contributed, and I think it really helped to round out the book a lot.
Well, of course, Anne's claim to fame, she has her own, of course, but her parents founded the American Vegan Society, and they've been leading the way for decades, helping people learn about why plant foods are so important.
Yeah, it's really nice. Anne comes from a vegan family. It's fantastic. And, you know, that actually just reminded me, my own family is kind of unusual in that not only are my kids vegan, but my sister is also vegan and her husband and all of her kids.
Hmm.
And my parents, while they don't identify themselves as being vegan, I would say that 99% of what they put in their mouth is vegan. I mean, I think that my dad probably has clam chowder once a year, and
mm-hmm.
that might be the only thing he does that deviates. So I'm really fortunate to be living in a vegan family where all of our family dinners are vegan, all the holidays are vegan, everything. My parents have a boat and, you know, all the food on the boat is vegan, when the, even when they're racing and other people are on the boat, even if my sister and I aren't there, it's all the vegan lasagna and the vegan chili and the vegan soups, you know, and they really, I'm just really proud of them and proud to be, you know, in their family.
Well, I want to talk about that a little more. I'm pretty fortunate, too, in that my brother and sister are vegan. My brother raises his children vegetarian. And my parents, I'm absolutely convinced, eat a lot healthier since they've been in the circle of vegans.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And we have... But my mother's really great in the kitchen, and she's come up with lots of great vegan recipes just because she really wants to please. But there are a lot of people that aren't that lucky and really are frustrated within their own family, the challenges they have, with their partners, with their children. At work, they feel really intimidated. And what do they do?
You know, there's so many different ways to approach it, but my own take on it is it's more important just to be nice and to be loving with the people that you're with, even if what they're doing is very frustrating to you. I don't know anyone who became vegan because someone told them that they should. It was usually because they read a book or they watched a film or they were around people that they liked that were eating vegan and they became interested in it. But when if someone... you know, was bossy to somebody and said, oh, you're doing it all wrong and your food is gross, whatever. People, I don't believe, really become vegan for those reasons. So if you are interested in kind of spreading the vegan message, I believe that you've just got to be the nicest person that you can be and be able to answer people's questions intelligently if they ask.
Do it with love. Do it with joy.
Do it with love. Do it with joy, and have a lot of good food around. You know, and if, you know, the one time I think it's difficult for people though is Thanksgiving. You know, as a vegan person living in a non-vegan world, we're exposed to meat. You know, or should I say, in this instance, we might even view it as animal carcasses all year round, seeing it on people's tables, on the menus, etc. But Thanksgiving is a celebration of peace. And on that particular day, I think it's harder for vegans to sit down and celebrate that joy and peace when there is a carcass of a harmed animal on a table.
Yeah, there's so much hypocrisy at that point.
Yes, and so I can understand why a lot of vegans do not want to be with their family on Thanksgiving. It's just too difficult. And like my family example, we just open it up to whoever wants to come. You know, there's always a lot of vegan people that come because it's just too difficult to eat with their family on that particular holiday. And the ironic thing is that the other family members who are not vegetarian or vegan, they're looking at it from the complete opposite. Like, on all days, this should be the day of all days that you can eat with us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this is the day that it's a family day. You know, it's a family holiday. So there's a lot to it when it comes to Thanksgiving.
Well, it's very symbolic of the whole vegan, non-vegan scene, because I think those that don't want to eat the turkey are really relating it to a really bigger picture of exploitation and pain and suffering, and here we are being thankful for everything that we have. Why do we want to abuse something in order for us to be thankful? It really doesn't make sense. And then on the other hand, those that connect food with their culture and their family and tradition and upbringing and have a really hard time acknowledging the truth behind some of those things that they've always found so comforting and beautiful, it's a challenge.
Yeah. And I'm sure that your listeners are familiar with United Poultry Concerns, Karen Davis's organization, and I know that she's written on the subject, and she has a lot of, you know, very wise things to say on the subject.
Yeah, I did talk to her some while ago, but she has she's recently revised a book. I'm looking. Do you remember the title of it?
You might be talking about More Than a Meal.
No.
But there's several books that there's many books that she's written.
Right.
Though.
Oh, there's one I'm just looking in my little library right now to see. if I could find the title, oh my goodness.
The Poultryless Potpourri?
No. Oh gosh. Oh well. You'll have to check my archives and look for her, but she's done a lot of great work for the birds.
Mhm. Yeah. And I suspect that we'll see more written on that by many people, because I see it as a topic that will bring growing awareness as more and more people become vegan, and not just for health reasons, but to make us a more peaceful world.
Okay, well, let's just talk about a couple of things that are in the news that kind of relate to all of this. So you've heard about the egg recall that came up a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, so these eggs, millions and millions of them, are tainted with salmonella. And I'm reading a bunch of articles on it, and one of them is trying to calm the public and what to do about it. But the thing that just irks me is the one part that says, how do eggs become contaminated? And I'm reading here from Business Week. The FDA is still trying to determine the cause of contamination in eggs involved in the recall, but unlikely sources include rodents or contaminated feed. This is so ridiculous. We know the cause. The cause is these poor birds living in filthy, cramped, inhumane, horrific conditions where the filth just spreads.
Yeah. It's ridiculous that it's even being questioned as to where it comes from. I mean, we hear about these stories of inhumanity where, like, a dog has been kept chained up in a doghouse, or a person is locked in a closet or whatever, and then they have to spend, 2 weeks in a hospital afterwards just getting healthy after living in their own filth.
Mm-hmm.
Just imagine if you had a whole bunch of people living in a closet, or there are like five dogs crammed in a doghouse, for 2 years. I mean, it's crazy. Of course there's going to be sickness. But the shock is that there aren't more recalls.
It is.
A total shock.
It is.
I've been under the impression that almost all the eggs are tainted. It's just, for whatever reason, this particular batch was tainted enough so that people actually started getting very, very sick, of course.
That's right. Well, people do. There's a lot of foodborne illness. A lot of it isn't explained. People are sick all the time. I hear people all the time, I've got a stomach bug or something. They ate something that wasn't good for them.
And I remember that back, 20-plus years ago, before I became vegan, it was not uncommon, once or twice a year,
mm-hmm.
to be out sick for like 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
You hear people say, it's coming out both ends, and it was just sort of par for the course. I think I ate something last night. It was bad fish, bad chicken, bad whatever. That has never happened ever since I became vegan. And I think it's because if you taste a bad vegetable, you know it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know it instantaneously. It's not a hidden thing the way it is with animal products.
Right. That's really interesting. Occasionally, and I don't want to get really gross here, but occasionally I've eaten something, and it could have been highly seasoned, so it wasn't that obvious, but if my body doesn't like it, it sends it right back out.
Yes, it's going to reject it.
Reject it quickly. I might feel bad, for a few minutes. It comes out and I'm done. It's not like I have a stomach bug.
Yeah.
And so the vitality in someone who's eating healthy foods becomes really strong.
Yes.
And some people may take that the bad way, where they used to be able to eat poor quality foods and not feel bad.
Yeah.
They don't realize the cumulative effects over time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone who, has that vitality because they're always eating quality foods, when something bad goes down, they'll feel bad for the moment.
Yeah. I have so many clients that have changed their diets, no dairy, minimal or no other animal products. They really purify themselves. And inevitably, they will eventually eat a piece of cheesecake, or they'll have some eggplant parmesan, or they'll have, some kind of a meat product. And they will be sick for a couple of days, anywhere from like 1 to 2 days. They'll feel low energy. It'll take them a few days to get back on track. and they come in and tell me what happened. And it's basically, congratulations, you have purified your body to the point that it will reject that stuff that you put in it now. And then they know they're staying off that stuff because they know it doesn't agree with their body rather than because somebody is telling them they shouldn't eat it.
Well, this is we're out of time, and this has been really, really fun. I love talking about food, and especially with someone like you who is on the same page as I am. Please visit Mary Beth's website. I'm going to spell it MariBethAbrams.com. MaryBethAbrams.com. Check out the book, The Four Ingredient Vegan. Lots of yummy, delicious things in there. Thank you so much, Mary Beth, for joining me today.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week. Bye-bye.